Thank you for tuning in. This is Matt Santos with the Mile High Show. Today, we've got a great show with Cynthia Sobo, the founder and director of the Mile High Comedy Theater, based out of Prescott, Arizona. It's a comedy troupe, workshops, improv classes, all things comedy for here in the Prescott area. Cynthia is going to tell us a little bit about her time writing for the bigs, working on some TV pilots, doing stand-up at some of the iconic clubs in Southern California and all over the place before settling here in Prescott. And she can tell us why she came here, what led up to her move here. We're recording today at Brick and Bones, a restaurant, bar, and great music venue in Prescott, Arizona. They also have a comedy show coming up on January 24th. And the day before that, Cynthia and her group will be performing at the historic and beautiful Elks Theater in Prescott, Arizona. We'll have more information on that show. That's January 23rd. We'll have a link also on our website about that. So without further ado, let's get on with the show, and we're going to listen to Cynthia Sobo of the Mile High Comedy Theater. Cynthia Sobo, thanks for coming in. First, give us just a quick little, you know, the Reader's Digest bio. What brought you to Prescott?
Okay,
first off?
The Reader's Digest bio. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm from Los Angeles, California. And I started out there as a stand-up comedian and was a professional television writer. And I had a baby. I had a daughter and wanted a better quality of life. And my husband at the time, we were helping take care of his mom, who was suffering from Alzheimer's. And my mom retired up here. And I said, you know what? Let's get out of L.A.
Now, how long had you been doing stand-up?
I started stand-up. I had been doing stand-up for about 6 years, and then that launched me into a professional writing career.
Gotcha.
So then I was writing professionally. I worked on a sitcom. I've been a television writer and producer, series story editor. So a lot of fun stuff along the way, but my love and my passion always was stand-up comedy.
Yeah. I want to get the whole history, but right at the start, I want to encapsulate a few. Your stand-up career here with the Mile High Comedy Theater is, give us the gist of that. Because there's not a huge comedy scene here in Prescott, but there are scattered shows here and there, including the 23rd of January.
Yes, at the Elks Theater.
Elks Theater, milehighcomedytheater.com.
Yes, MileHighComedyTheater.com will give you information on the show. And to buy tickets is PrescottElksTheater.com.
Okay, and that'll be January 23rd.
Yeah.
Now, you started that. How long has the Mile High Comedy Theater been going on? And no affiliation to the Mile High Show.
Correct.
Just a coincidence.
Just affiliation to the Mile High City that we all share.
I'm getting a lot of feedback online when I post things from like the legalized marijuana coalitions and things. Well, you know, if it drives traffic,
there
I'll
is,
take it.
Yeah, exactly. There is another Mile High City that's famous for some other things. So, well, we first started classes about almost a year ago in February, and it started
out.
It's
a fairly new troupe. It's a pretty new organization.
Yeah, we have some members that have been from the beginning. We've had some members that have joined. We've had some members that have had life commitments that have had to move on. But basically, it started. I had actually done a stand-up gig at Brick and Bones,
right where we're sitting.
Where we're sitting, and the comedy night. And I got to be honest, I was like, you know what? I love this. I miss this.
Now, how long had that gap been since you had done stand-up?
It had been a long time. The last time I had performed stand-up, because remember, in between that, I'd had a professional writing career.
Writing gigs.
And
then the move and the child.
So it had probably been about 15 years that I had done stand-up because it was actually right before I got married, and I did a gig at the Comedy Store in L.A., because I was getting married, and I wanted my husband to see, you know, exactly
what he was getting into.
Yeah. So it had been a long time, and it was funny because I started doing the math right before I went up. I was like, oh wow,
been a little bit.
But you know what? It really is like riding a horse. I mean, once you get into joke writing and you know developing your material, it just becomes something you start doing in your head while you're driving. You're just going over your bits and going over your act. And so after that night, I thought, I really want to do stand up, but there's not a lot of opportunities in this town. And I have a full-time job and a daughter, and I can't be driving to Phoenix. So why don't I develop something on my own? And it turned into, I thought, you know, we have stand-up because we do have the comedy night here at Brick and Bones. We do have improv. We have PCA that has the Improvatonians. But I wanted to do something different that would be a whole night of comedy.
Gotcha.
So our shows are a combination of improvisational comedy, sketch comedy, and stand-up. So it's just go out there, and we're going to do anything and everything we can to make you laugh and have a good time.
All right, let's drop back now.
Okay,
even pre-stand-up, we'll work ourselves back up to the 23rd, which is coming up. Hopefully, I'm going to plan on posting this next Monday, so that'll give us a little lead in. What was your household growing up like? Were you siblings, an only child?
No, I have an older sister, and my sister is funny in her own quirky way. And I think, you know, growing up, I was just always told I was funny. I was the class clown. And to be honest, I kind of fell into stand-up because after going through everything in college and going through all the majors and things I could do, none of them looked interesting.
Nothing fun.
Nothing really piqued my interest.
Were your parents funny? Were they cut-ups?
No.
Or what'd they do for work? What'd your folks do for work?
My dad was an electrical engineer, and my mom worked for the city of Long Beach. And I love them dearly, but they're not funny.
So you were the household cut up?
Yeah.
Was that rough for you in school, or did your teachers kind of
go with it? No, I was, you know what, here's the thing. I was a good student, and I think they thought I was funny, too, because they... I didn't get in trouble for it probably as much as I should have.
So they encouraged it a little bit at school.
Yeah.
Your folks, did they foster the desire to... be in the limelight and be a cut up, or
you know,
was it just your kind of thing? They let
it
you
was
alone?
Just my kind of thing, you know. I mean, I after high school, like I said, I kind of floundered. There were the things that I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll try this, and you know, I thought I wanted to be an actress, and I found out I wasn't very good at that, and you know, I knew I was creative. I just hadn't found the outlet for it, and I remember. I had taken a stand-up comedy. Well, first when I made the decision, I was like, okay, I lived in Long Beach, but believe it or not, moving to LA was a big move.
Yeah.
So I was going to move to LA, and I took Greg Dean's stand-up comedy class, who still is, I think, has classes and some books and workshops, and developed a small set. And then after that, at the, you know, in L.A., there's lots of open mics.
Yeah.
There's lots of opportunities to explore.
How was the comedy scene there? Because it goes through phases. It's going really strong now. There were some, you know, it like I said, it goes in stages. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, right outside of Oakland. And when I was in high school and when I graduated, the comedy scene was just booming. It was huge in the early 80s in the Bay Area. And got to see some great names coming through my work. You know, by trade, I'm a photographer, and I did headshots for guys and shot at a lot of the clubs around there. And it was a great time for comedy. every bar, every restaurant had a comedy night. And then early 90s, it just, boom, nosedive. Clubs were closing up left
and
right.
Well, you know why?
Why?
Why? Well, because what happened was, at that time, comedy was hitting the scene, and so was Comedy Central.
Yeah.
And what would happen is that they scooped up people, and they did one-hour shows. Right? So you'd see your favorite stand-up comedian and they do a one-hour set. Yeah. And people didn't realize that a one-hour set was something that you built and honed
for years and years.
So then they would go to a nightclub, pay a cover charge, have an expensive two-drink minimum, and go, wait, it's the same. Well, it's the same thing. Wait, I just saw this on Comedy Central. Yeah. He's doing the same jokes. So I think that's why it flattened and bottomed out, because people realized that, you know, what these people got. So, you know, and that was a time, too, when all the comics, you know, at least in L.A. and I don't know if the Bay Area, but all the comics were working for a sitcom deal.
Yeah.
Everybody was looking to try and get a series. Everybody, you know, was trying to get out. Yeah.
One of the things, too, that I saw, at least up where I was at, it's kind of like when when expansion baseball comes through. All of a sudden, the pitching gets really weak. It starts getting diluted, and that's what it seemed like there. You'd see some really strong folks coming through for a few years, and then you'd hit a club, and it would, you know, it's the guy who everybody told him was funny at work, and you know, with the lights in his face and the mic in front of his mouth, he's not kicking out what he wants to.
Yeah.
It just got really diluted, and it was hurting them financially. Again, there was a club on every corner.
Right.
Was it still pretty strong when you started in L.A.? Was it?
It was harder and harder to get gigs. You know, I was really lucky in that I really didn't work that hard on getting work. I had a lot of comics. There's a lot of camaraderie. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's a tough business. It wasn't something, I always had a part-time job. It wasn't something that I could support myself fully. But I could get week-long gigs because a comic would recommend me, and I could open. There was a comedy club in Long Beach, and, you know, there were things here and there that, you know, could open or middle for. I didn't headline. I didn't have a long enough set. I did do a cruise for a National Lampoon comedy cruise. So, you know, the gigs were here and there and spotty. And then that's how I, you know,
what was
basically
your favorite club to work in? What were some of the fun ones? I noticed on the theater's website, it listed some of your credit, Ice House, Comedy Store, some of the biggies. What was your favorite room to work?
My favorite, there was a place called The Laugh Stop, and it was in West Hollywood, and I liked that. That was fun. And the Comedy Store, just because you just never know. You never knew who was going to be in there, you know. So it's like you'd be walking down the hall and all of a sudden be, oh, my gosh, you know. So
yeah, a buddy of mine that I grew up with, he's running a show in the belly room right now every week. He's loving it. But who were some of the names that you came across? Who were some of the ones that you enjoyed watching? Who would you stick around to watch after your?
Well, you know who would be at some of the open mics, and people that would work out material would be Patton Oswalt. And one of my favorite at the time, so I loved to go see, was Mitch Hedberg.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing him in L.A. and just he performed stand-up with just a guy behind him doing the upright bass, just a boom, 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 boom. And literally laughing so hard that it ached. It hurt, and it felt so good, you know?
I got to see him in San Francisco a couple of times. Great shows, yeah.
But, and then some people that, you know, I palled around with at the time, Stephanie Wilder Taylor. She has her own show on, I think, Nickelodeon. Moms, I don't know, parental indiscretion, and Wayne Fetterman. I know that he was writing for Jimmy Fallon's show, and Jamie Kennedy used to always come. I used to run an open mic, and he used to come to my open mic and
Fetterman
stuff.
Was just in, who did it? I Am Road Comic. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Great film.
Oh, okay.
Check it out. It's the same guy that did I Am Comic.
Oh, okay.
I forget who it was. Used to be a stand-up, and now he's a filmmaker. He's a director.
Yeah, last time I saw him, he's actually now in the Geico commercial with Kenny Rogers. He's sitting next to him if you see him. I don't know if he has a line, but, you know, he's right there.
Well, did you run into any challenges being a female comic in, you know, there's so many of the old school, the old guard that still believe women can't be funny. Women can't be funny. We know that's not true. The great comic minds, especially writers, showrunners, and things that blow that theory out of the water. But some of the old school guys and some of the comedy club owners and runners still kind of have that mentality. Did you ever run across that much?
Oh, yeah.
What were some of the
issues? You'd get a comp, you know, the biggest compliment you would get would be, "You're really funny for a girl." "No, really? Yeah. You're really funny." You know, it's like, "Well, thank you." But I think the biggest compliment that I would get after I'd perform is people would tell me, you're a really smart writer. You're a good writer.
Yeah.
And that always held a lot of credence with me. I was like, okay, good. I'm doing it right, you know. And
were you more of a joke writing, or was it long form storytelling? What was your strong suit?
It's not more storytelling. It's more joke writing. It's more setup and punch, and a little. I'd say my character on stage is a little bit quirky and bent. you know, and people would say I was a little bit like Ellen DeGeneres or Laura Keitlinger, or, you know, I kind of talk about just weird or maybe normal subjects and take them to the extreme.
With a different set of glasses. Now, you mentioned Ellen and Laura Keitlinger. Were they kind of your influences coming up? Who did you like watching before you took the stage, before you even did stand-up? Who were some of your comedic heroes?
Probably Ellen. I mean, you know, it's interesting because I never really watched comics. Most of the comics that I watched were people that I were working, you know, that I was working with.
Even before that, like in growing up, were you a comedy junkie?
You know,
no?
I wasn't really a comedy nerd. I was a sitcom person.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, I loved, you know, things like The Carol Burnett Show, Bob Newhart. You know, I definitely love the dry
Friday
wit
nights
and the
for me growing up.
and the dry comedy. I'm not really a big broad comedy type of fan. So I think I've always gone for the writing, the joke, the structure.
Yeah, structure.
Yeah, just the structure.
So 6 years doing stand up about before you went into writing full time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember your first night?
My first night.
Your first night. It was, I'm assuming, like an open mic.
Well, my first open mic that I did, because I, like I said, I had done the workshop, which was very, what's the word I'm looking for? It was, you know, it was like your friends and very supportive.
Yeah.
You know,
a forgiving
it's
supportive,
like
audience.
Yeah, the bouncy house of debuts. Yeah. You know, it's okay.
Get used to talking and the fact that there's a microphone in front of you and get your timing and stuff.
And then I do remember the first open mic I had done, and it was in Westwood, which was right by UCLA, so it was a lot of college kids and stuff. And now I'm dating myself because I took a micro cassette recorder and I put it on a table when I went up and did my set. And you know, the thing about stand up, you know, now I rarely get nervous before I go on stage, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know, in the beginning, you know, it was I would roll out of bed and just be like, I'm going to do an open mic, you know, and just kind of be shaking the whole night, you know, the whole day, and then get to it. But I remember I did this set, and, you know, the adrenaline was pumping. I was, you know, shaking, and I got up and I did my set, and I took the micro cassette recorder back with me to the car, and I listened to it, and the people at the table said, "Wow, she's really funny."
Nice.
And I just, like, that was it. I was hooked.
Do you still have the tape?
I don't. Yeah. I didn't even know if I could find something to play it on. You know? It's like if you have an 8-track tape, what do you, you know?
Use it to hold up the end of your coffee table.
Exactly.
That's what I do. Now, so how it was just good, supportive first run. What was your first bomb like? I'm going to bet you got one or two in
No, no, no. Every comic bombs. Yeah. And you know, in the comedy and stand-up comedy workshops that I've taught, you know, we talk about that. Like, to me, it's up to the comic to entertain the audience. And one thing I hated seeing was a comic turn on the audience because the material wasn't working.
Yeah.
If you're bombing on stage, you need to make the audience feel comfortable with your bombing. They've paid to see a comedy show. For me, I always found that when I played later gigs, because my material was a little bit more, I don't know how to describe it. Let's just say, like, when people were drunk. I'm not one of those comics that you had to think too hard, maybe.
A well-lubricated audience is a good thing.
Yeah, a well-lubricated audience was not a good thing for me. I was better with the subtle buzz than the the hammered. But, you know, again, I remember, there was a couple times when you would just go up and you would do the same joke that last week. Yeah. People were just slapping the table, and then you did it someplace else, and then were crickets.
Yeah.
And you just were okay. So you have to have the confidence, and again, you can bomb, and the audience can still have fun watching you bomb.
As long as they don't get uncomfortable.
That's the trick.
I think Carson Johnny Carson did the best. It was almost funnier when his jokes fell flat in his monologue. That was even better in the way he handled it and kept the audience with him, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, some guys who take that as an opportunity to walk the room and get.
You know, I would see people be like, "What are you, stupid? You know, you didn't get that? You know, like, don't."
Most of your stage time, was it in Southern Cal? Did you do any long road trips or anything?
No.
You tried to stay close?
No.
Now, you got married after you started or before?
Yeah, no, I got married. Yeah, I got married 15 years ago.
Were you still doing stand-up when you got married? You said
you
had already, okay.
Yeah, I was, at that point, I was writing professionally.
Now, how did you get your first writing gig?
Through stand-up.
Somebody in the audience?
No, well, other comics. Basically,
referred?
Yeah. Actually, my friend Stephanie, that I mentioned previously, there was a dating game show in Los Angeles called Buzz.
Yeah.
And actually, I wrote with, it was me and Neil Brennan, who mm-hmm. went on to co-produce the Dave Chappelle Show, and my friend Anthony. And, you know, it was fun. It was my first full-time job. It was a Writers Guild.
Yeah.
But it was funny. There's kind of a funny story behind it, because I remember Neil... you know, we all got into the Writers Guild from that show. It was a Writers Guild show. And, you know, I was all excited to go to the intro luncheon. I'm like, hey, I'm in the Writers Guild, you know. And Anthony and Neil were like, oh, we're not going to go. So I go, and the woman there, when I check in, says, oh, great, welcome to the Writers Guild. That's so awesome. So tell us, you know, what did you sell a screenplay? Are you working on a sitcom? And I said, well, no, I write for a dating game show. And there's this long pause, and she kind of goes like, hey, Becky, did you know you could get in the Writers Guild from writing on a game show? You know, and it's like bubble just goes, pew! So... then I just felt, you know, I'm going around the little mixer.
Now you know
all
why
lonely.
They didn't show up.
Yeah, I know. Like, thanks, guys.
Yeah. How long were you on Buzz?
For about 2 seasons.
Yeah.
Did that. And then we got, at that point, I was also working with a writing partner. And then we got hired. We worked on a sitcom called Fired Up. We won the Paramount. There was a Paramount Studio Writers Competition. We won that. We were a finalist in the Warner Brothers Television Writers Program. It's been where my career has gone. It is not normal. I mean, basically, I got into sitcom writing because somebody that I worked with when I was doing stand-up said, I think you're really funny, and I want to write with you. And I said, okay. And he was at a party and met a showrunner for a sitcom, and they asked him, do you have a writing partner? And he said, yes, I do. Her name is Cynthia. And he goes, oh, do you have a spec script? And he goes, why, yes, we do. And he goes, great. What show is it for? And he goes, and again, dating myself, he goes, Mad About You. And he goes, okay, great. Get it to me in, like, you know, next week. I said, okay. And Edward called me up and said, guess what? We're writing a script. And we literally did that whole, like, he was at my apartment. We slept. We went to work. I was also writing coverage for a film company, doing script reading. And we finished that in 2 weeks. And the next week, we had an agent. One of the top agents in LA. So it was, you know, when people ask me about the business, it's like, okay, things don't normally happen that way, but this is how it happened.
But you'll take it.
And I'll take it. Yeah, it was awesome.
So what were some of the shows that you wrote for after the date, your Buzz?
We did Buzz, and then I, like I said, we worked on Fired Up, my writing partner and I.
Now, did that run, or?
It went a season. It did a half season. They sold the pilot, and then it ran for one more season, and then that was it.
That's
it
a good
got
run.
Canceled.
That's a good run, though, because when you think about all the pilots that get made and never aired, first the ones that get picked that get written and never made, then the ones that get made that never run, then the ones that get made run and never get picked up. To get one to run a season, that's you're batting a pretty good average there.
Yeah. No, I mean, we didn't write we didn't write that. But we did sell a television pilot to Columbia TriStar. My writing partner and I sold a television pilot. But like you said, this was one of the unfortunate things. We were all set to go, and then the person that bought it got fired. And so, you know, in the studio world, it's like no one's going to pick up projects. Like somebody just fired.
I'm not going to get that on me.
So, yeah.
What was the gist? What was the plot of the pilot?
You know what? It was kind of like, and this was before the original remake of the Charlie's Angels came out. It was kind of like, it was a tongue-in-cheek, campy kind of Starsky and Hutch, but with a male and a female cop. And it was funny and it was good and we got paid, which was nice, but it never went anywhere. So after that, at that point in time, there were a lot of shows that were just ending. Roseanne, I think Home Improvement, and the pool of accomplished and seasoned writers
lot of folks with experience looking for work.
We were, my writing partner and I were like neck and neck. It was between us and another writing team for Will and Grace, and the show's producer was friends with the other writing team. So after that, it was a year we were just pitching, trying to get freelance scripts, and we pitched for a whole year. And then after that, my friend said, hey, I have some consistent work, and I started writing and producing one-hour shows for Discovery Channel, Learning Channel, Animal Planet.
What were your duties on some of those shows?
Basically, excuse me, for the, let's say the Learning Channel, well, now it's TLC.
Yeah.
Back in the day, with the Learning Channel kids.
On the move.
You know, they would give you a topic. Like, they had a series called The Secret World Of. And so I worked on a show called The Secret World of Monster Trucks. And basically, they would give you the subject, and you would have to figure out the show. You'd
and
research
go out and
it.
Run with it, huh?
Yeah, who you're going to interview, what's the act structure going to be like, find your footage. and do all that. And some of the other things, like when I did stuff for Animal Planet, it was actually reality. They went out and shot all the footage and then brought it back, and then you would have to make a show out of that footage. So
put it together to tell a story and be appealing and informative. There's a stark difference between that and scripted storytelling. Do you have a preference, or... At that point, was it just to keep working?
At that point, after we had, after we had worked and then spent the year, I mean, when my writing partner and I were out pitching scripts, I mean, I was basically unemployed. You know, I didn't have a second job.
Unemployed in Hollywood?
I know.
That's so rare.
Yeah, an unemployed writer? Shut the front door. So, so after that, I was like, you know what? I need steady work. You know, and I landed with a fun group of people, and I have a lot of funny and crazy stories. And so it was just, it was a next chapter, and it was fun.
Now, were you employed when you were doing for Discovery and TLC Learning Channel? Mm-hmm. Were you employed by them, or were you working for a production company?
I was working for a production company. So we had a multitude of contracts with them, and it was great because, you know, a show would end, and then I would just move to a new show because they had, and then I did some freelance field producing and stuff. Even when I was here, I did a dog show in Chino Valley. I did a dog show.
At an old home manor?
I can't remember, a couple years ago. And then in Vegas, I field produced a Hooters swimsuit calendar reunion. Yeah.
A reunion. How long of a reunion was it?
Oh, I don't know.
One-piece swimsuit?
It was crazy.
Can't wear that swimsuit. It's got a hole in the knee.
Yeah. Well, no. But then they had the new Hooters girls and stuff, and, you know.
And rough gig, but, you know, if it's got to pay the... You ever need somebody to carry your camera bags or anything, give me a holler. I'll have to run that by my wife, though. I don't think it'll work. So that brings you to Prescott.
That brings me to Prescott. And, I thought, well, gosh, what can I do? And I thought, I wanted something. I thought about times when I was happiest. And I used to be a camp counselor and work with youth at the YMCA. And obviously I want to do something creative. So I thought, hey, I'll go into teaching. And then there was an opening in the Career and Technical Education Department to teach media, and I've been there ever since.
And what are some of the projects you're doing there? Are you based out of Bradshaw or no?
I'm at Bradshaw Mountain High School, and broadcast TV and broadcast television and film. We've gone through a variety of name changes.
How big of a program is that? How many students are partaking in that? Rough estimate. Is it a full-day schedule for you?
It's a full-day schedule. Okay. This is like my sixth year teaching an extra class. So, and then this year I took over as yearbook advisor. So,
nice.
Yeah. So I have in my intro classes, I have a 30-seat computer lab, Mac lab, and it's all full. So it's 160, 170 students.
What kind of video production are you guys doing? What are some of the projects you have your students working on?
Well, the intro students, a lot of times it's just learning editing concepts and skills. Separating A-roll from B-roll, coverage and that sort of thing. They do stop-motion animation, just kind of the basic stuff. We use Final Cut Pro 10, so they are using professional nonlinear editing systems. The advanced do the morning announcements, so they run it, the morning news, every day. We've had some tech problems, so it's been a little spotty this year. But they do that, and so they'll create content for the morning news. They'll do commercials for people on campus. And we also have an organization called Skills USA, which is a student technical organization that's national. And our news team took third place last year in state. So it's a great program, and I still get to be creative and get blown away by their creativity. And that's the fun part of,
now,
of that.
On that end, you know, flexing those creative muscles, you know, obviously it would be great. You've got 160 some students, and they all go on to work for Channel 12 or go to L.A. or New York to work in a major market. But the reality is they're not. You know, some of these kids obviously won't even choose to go that route. You know, that might not be their interest. What are they able to get out of this that'll help them in any career they choose? Some of these production and performing and things. How are they benefiting from that?
Well, every business is media based. There is. You know, I mean, now everything is social media, you know, Twitter, Facebook. You have to know how to reach a target audience, how to edit, how to do all of those things, you know. And I think that years ago, broadcast journalism was a separate degree and skill set. But you've got to know these skills for every single job out there. And then in addition, it also just teaches media literacy to these kids. Once they know the process, they know how they can be manipulated from sound, by sound edits, by video edits, by juxtaposition. So it's a crucial course.
What have you seen, or are there examples you've seen of I've seen it with photography and with writing. People that really don't have an interest in it when I'm working with some kids, but once they can see start to finish a project go, the boost to their confidence, and it gives them a little courage to go out and tackle new things when they can see a project they've created from one to the other, one end to the other. I would imagine it would be even more so, tenfold more when they're actually doing something, say, on camera. Do you see that boost their confidence and help them in that area?
Definitely. One thing when I first started teaching the course that I didn't understand is the hesitancy. And I had just crossed over in careers, and I mistook it for like, well, they're being lazy. They're not doing it. And then I realized they were afraid that it was a creative expression that they hadn't explored.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, they were daunted by learning the technical skills, but also the vulnerability in showing their creativity, you know, and expressing themselves.
Having a mic in front of your face or a camera pointed at you.
Or just taking images. So I just, you know, I try and make the classroom very encouraging, and I always tell my students, I said, the thing about production is a lot of times your learning curve happens in post.
Yeah.
You know, you get to the end and you go, oh, that's what she meant, you know. And that's okay, you know. I mean, you have to make mistakes and you have to trip up. And I just, you know, push them along and say, don't worry, it's now it's cemented. Now you know. Now the next shoot, you know. So.
And when you started up the Mile High Comedy Theater, same thing. Are you seeing people coming in to get, like, skills they can use away from the stage, or are primarily your students and the participants in your program ones that want to go out and perform specifically for comedy or improv?
We have both. We have people that didn't realize that they wanted to perform. People that have said, you know, people have told me I've always been told I'm funny, but they don't have an outlet. And they think in Prescott that they don't have an outlet, but they do. And that was a big push behind why I created this. And I had this idea for it. Because I wanted something for the community, but also for the people in the community to come in. You know, you don't necessarily have to want to be a professional. You just come in and you have fun and you get to be creative. So we've had, you know, business people come in. It helps them in their business. We have people that, like I said, they just, it's their funny outlet all their friends tell them they're funny, and now they get a chance to show off. And then there's people that say, hey, I'm going to start writing and see what I can do. And
so you have writing workshops as well to help them develop their own material and things?
Well, right now I'm actually writing a TV pilot with one of the cast members.
Oh, nice.
So we're doing a little side project. The stand-up, I did a stand-up workshop last year, and I think this year there are going to be some standalone workshops for beginners, just an introduction to joke writing and then honing your material. And then, you know, I don't know, sitcom writing has always been a love of mine, but, you know, that's kind of, you know, dying out. Like you said, you know, I mean, the cost of producing a show is so great that if it doesn't hit right off the bat, they'll tank it after three, you know, sometimes even two, you know, episodes, and then you're
in recent years, though, we're seeing so many other outlets, you know, podcasting, YouTube, Vimeo, all the different areas people can go to self-produce their own work. Are you, what's your take on that, from seeing it from the industry side to now the social media and internet side? What, give us a little spin on how you see the industry going.
Well, I actually went to a filmmakers panel through Prescott Film, the Prescott Film Festival, and it was film producers and writers, and they were talking about the vision of that YouTube, you know, the idea of YouTube would go in the direction of directors and kind of crowdfunding, would go the way of having paid channels.
Yeah.
So you would, you know, put your seedling videos out there. Say, hey, you want to take a look at my video? It's 25 cents, right? If that's global, now you've got a lot of money.
It's a lot of quarters.
It's a lot of quarters. It adds up. And now you can maybe self-produce or do more crowdfunding and you know, do your own works. But I think, you know, there's people that will say, oh, we're going to lose movie theaters or you know, but I some things just have to be experienced.
Yeah.
In the dark collectively.
There's nothing like the lights going dim after the, you know, after the ads for whatever's on there.
Yeah.
When the lights go dim, the previews start. That's just, I've always enjoyed that. But then again, I'm old school. I like picking up a newspaper too. So,
yeah.
Now, how about from the TV production side? How do you see the industry changing with places like Netflix, Amazon doing self-produced, Hulu doing their self-produced shows? Is that just bolstering the industry?
I think it is. Well, what do you mean by bolstering, you know, the industry? I think it gives, what I will say is, I think it gives more opportunity for fresh writers and new writers and new talent to break in, definitely. Because, you know, I know when we were working, my writing partner and I were in sitcom, it was a very tight community, you know, and per union rules, Writers Guild rules, you would have to farm out and have three freelance scripts every season for a sitcom, with the idea that new writers could break in.
Yeah.
But everybody would just farm them out to their friends. We have three freelance, you know what I mean? Yeah. We have three freelance scripts. Oh, guess what? Joe's, you know, in between jobs right now.
Yeah.
You know, we would sit at the writer's table, and the showrunner would be, you know, we need a day player. And then somebody would say, well, so-and-so I know needs some money for their, you know, guild insurance, you know, to keep their guild insurance. All right, they're in. I think that it only helps new talent break in.
What are the shows that you like watching now? What's catching your eye on the entertainment horizon?
I do not have a lot of time, but the two shows that I do watch, I'm really enjoying The Mysteries of Laura and About a Boy.
The Mystery of Laura. Deborah Messing?
Yeah, okay. And About a Boy. And then as far as, you know, comedy stuff, I will, you know, I feel like if John Stewart wasn't alive, there wouldn't really be a reason to live. So
let's get back to the Mile High Comedy Theater. You got good ones there. John Stewart and Devin. Mile High Comedy Theater, you've got your show coming up on Friday the 23rd.
Yep.
Give us a rundown. What can folks expect when they buy their ticket and have a seat at the Elks Theater?
Well, when they first come in, they're going to see some tables, and we're going to be asking for audience suggestions for some games that we play. We do a game called Sentences, where the audience writes down random sentences. Our actors create a scene, and they have to pull out those sentences and organically integrate them into the scene. We also have a love expert that will be with us that the audience can ask their love questions or maybe some cuisine. You know, he's very worldly, and so he'll be giving advice out. And sketches, we've got sketches. We have Kathy Cowan. Like I said, she's a graduate of the stand-up comedy workshop. She's doing a set. And you know, everything we do as far as the improv games, I ask the audience for suggestions, and it's very interactive, and it's fun.
So good improv, skits, some stand-up.
Yeah.
You've been compared, the troupe, the theater's been compared in a couple of articles I was pulling up to, like, SNL and various other shows like that, so you can come
well,
in and see.
Well, that's nice.
See, you didn't see that? Oh, did you write that one?
No, I...
I think it was one of the ones that linked to the Elks. As far as that feeling, spontaneous, live, little interaction, and then a mix between some stand-up sketches and improv.
And the interesting thing about the Elks, and it was funny because I had done something in the Elks, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago for Fright Fest, and I was in there and I thought, wow, this is just it's a beautiful venue. And most improv and things that you see in L.A. are, you know, in small black box theaters.
Yeah.
And I remember when we first started, there was a guy from New York, and he kept telling me, he goes, it's not going to work at the Elks. It's not going to work. It's too big.
It's a beautiful
theater. It's too big. And I said, you know what? No, I see it. I can totally see it. There's a sense of intimacy in that theater. So that's what's interesting is that it works. I mean, it's a big crowd, but it feels like a small club when you're in there, you know?
What was the first show you guys did there? Because you did one this past October, wasn't it?
We did May, yeah. And then we did August. I'm sorry, I can't.
Okay. No, so it's been you know, you've done a few.
We've done two shows.
You've got the one in January, but you've got some scheduled coming up. This could be a regular thing, regular venue for you guys?
Well, I mean, we consider the Elks Theater our home.
Your home.
You know, that's where I originally envisioned it. It's a nice fit for us. And my intention, we have four shows booked out for the rest of this year. My intention is, you know, we have a show at once every 3 months. So it's an event. It gives us time. You know, we all have full-time jobs. Some of us two, some of us three.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gives us time to develop material. But also, you know, I want it to be fun, like an event. You know, the comedy circus is coming to town. Let's all, you know, come on out and get our laughs.
What's involved? What type of commitment are you looking for from your students? If somebody hears this or sees it online and they want to know what's going on at the Comedy Theater, how do they enroll? What kind of what kind of time commitment are they looking at? And
What kind of financial commitment? It's $30 a month for the beginning improv class. We have a free improvisational class that we're offering January 31st.
That's not even a cup of coffee a week.
I know. Well, here's the thing. I am a single mom. I'm a teacher. I don't want anyone to be turned away because they think, oh, you know, I can't afford it. I mean, we want this to be available to people, you know? I mean, my God, what better thing to give people but the ability to laugh and find that within themselves, you know? I mean, it's really healing. So, you know, that's why I kept it that way, you know. And there were people that, you know, I remember somebody said, well, if you don't make it more expensive, people are going to think that it's not a value. And I was like, you know what? No.
Nobody gets into comedy and gets rich. I mean, yeah, you've got
or teaching for that.
You've got your Seinfelds and yeah. your Dane Cooks and yeah. all the big wig. Yeah. Or somebody lands a sitcom or a mm-hmm. or a 1 hour special. But for every one of those folks, there's hundreds of others who are doing the runs for 200 miles away for 25 yeah. bucks or maybe a. Maybe maybe a meal or a free drink. Yeah. So it's not something people yeah. go, hey, I'm going to do this because I want to make money. So
right.
the transfer of that is to learn it mm-hmm. and get your chops going. It's not something that's going to break the bank.
Right. And not everyone's going to take the class to be in the cast. Yeah. We do have some openings for cast. We're looking to expand our cast. And so we do, you know, take those people from the beginning workshops and see how it all works, all the chemistry, see how people grow and if they're committed. But January 31st, we have a free improv class from 3 to 5 at Switch Performing Arts. It's absolutely free. So if you feel that tug or that pull or that curiosity, you can just come and work out with us.
And info and for that is on
milehighcomedytheater.com. They can go to the contact page and just say, hey, give me a heads up. Say, Cynthia, I'll be there. And I'll, you know, put your name down. We'll have some little snackies.
And what kind of time commitment for once somebody goes to the workshop?
Once a week, for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Once a week for an hour, we get together, we work on different things, we play different games, and you know, it's just getting into that groove, practicing, thinking on your feet.
And then the other 6 days a week you're working out in your brain, hopefully.
Yeah. And you know, and sometimes with the improv, you know, and that's where the sketches come in. It's like, oh my God, that'd be a great character. Yeah. You know, we work something out. I'm like, wait a minute, what if we blew that up into a sketch and this yeah. becomes a scene, you know? So it's, and it's very, we're all very supportive. You know, as corny as it sounds, we're a little family and, yeah. and.
So it's a way for folks to exercise those muscles, but not do so in an open mic. Where you're going to get the boos and the heckles. It's a way right. to kind of foster those, develop yeah. them, let them grow.
Yeah.
Now, that's so your show at the Elks on the 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
On the 24th, in the building we're sitting in now, and mm-hmm. I know it's not something that, it's not, your troupe's not promoting it, but it is a comedy night
yeah.
at Brick and Bones on January 24th. You have performed here. You said you know you've got yeah. a relationship. You know the way that. What can folks expect on the 24th? Say they come in on the 23rd, love your show, and go, I need to get more of this. What am I doing tomorrow night? Where do they do it? Is it out the patio upstairs?
It's usually in the loft.
In the loft.
Actually, one of our cast members did a stand up routine last comedy show mm-hmm. here. So we're very, you know, we're very supportive of
yeah.
any comedy that's going on. You know, it's not competition. It's, yeah. it's, we're all in this together,
so
you know.
I think it's like a $7 cover or something, if I saw
$7,
the sign right.
Yeah, $7 cover. Bobby, who's the promoter, he brings in people from L.A., people that are on the road. So you'll see a good mix yeah. of comedy. And it's a fun show.
Yeah, one of the guys I know is going to be here is Mike Dapper. He was at mm-hmm. Kevin Rose's show this
yeah.
past fall.
Yeah.
The Kevin Rose Comedy All-Stars. We sat down and talked with him a couple of weeks ago. Give us your take on Kevin. I know you've got
Kevin actually, he did stand up in our first show.
And you got an oldie picture of him on your website, I saw.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we were actually, when Mile High Comedy Theater started, we were together and starting it together and, you know, moving forward. And unfortunately, in the beginning stages, life takes over.
Oh, yeah.
And other commitments came up. And I was kind of standing in the crossroads of like, well, what do I do? And I just move forward. And, you know, it's been interesting, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the first class that I put out, nobody came to. And then you know, the funny thing is then I did a free improv class, and I had a small group of people show up, and then those people have been with me, and like I said, it's just grown and grown, and we just want more people to come, you know, and have fun, because that's what it's really about.
And that's what a lot of people don't realize, that there is a comedy scene here. They figure, oh, comedy, we got to go down to Phoenix, mm-hmm. we got to go to Scottsdale. But between your troupe, every couple of months a show at the Elks,
mm-hmm.
Kevin Rose is getting some more scheduled up,
mm-hmm.
the comedy nights here at Brick and Bones, there mm-hmm. was one, another one a couple months ago with the comedy doc, the guy from the UK.
Oh, uh-huh.
That was put on, I think, by Mello B, the same guy that's doing this one.
Mm-hmm.
So there's shows sporadically through. You got a lot of that's going through Facebook to find them,
mm-hmm.
the bar listings.
Right.
The Courier, Daily Courier, D Courier Online has a lot of that stuff. So for comedy fans and just folks looking for something other than going to a bar and listening to some music or
mm-hmm.
hitting the theater and seeing a movie, there's a lot of options for some live entertainment. One of them being seek out some local comedy, support the local comics.
Yeah.
It's not an easy gig to do, to get up in front of people, standing alone, holding a microphone, and having, you know, dozen or so or 30 or 40 folks staring at you, expecting you to entertain them and make you laugh.
But you know
it's
what?
It's a scary thing.
Once you do it and you accomplish it, you're like, I can do anything.
If it works. Otherwise, you crawl back in your hole. Years back, I was did a lot of headshots for comics and that in the San Francisco Bay Area. And one of the guys, he's a character actor now. I reached out to him a few years ago. He vaguely remembers a few nights with me, but we would go. These were nights we would.
These were nights before you were married.
Oh, long ago. Long, long ago.
Nights your wife would not let you have right now.
We would, in the San Francisco Bay Area, Alex Bennett had a radio show. He started on Camel and then went to 98. What was it, 98.9? I forget, the Quake. 6 a.m. It was just a standard morning radio show. He had his sidekick. He had his news. What was her name? I forget now. The news gal. But the whole thing was he would have stand-up comics come in and plug their shows. I was there the morning that Bobcat Goldthwait flew in from Boston. Joe Rogelski, the sidekick, went to the airport, picked him up, and brought him directly to the show. We saw everybody coming through there. And typically, we were coming in from our night before to go to his 6 a.m. show. And one of the guys that I used to pal around with a lot, he ran an open mic at a little bar in North Beach. And we used to just hang out all the time, partying all night. And he convinced me to get up and do the open mic. And the winner of the open mic would win $50. That's how they build it. Well, I won that night, but it was not $50. It was $50 in, you got 22.50 drink tickets. The thinking was you would pass them out to people, and then those people would like it. You know, oh, hey, I got a free drink, and then come back for the next open mic.
Gotcha.
I wasn't going to let them go. I was going to keep them. Until I realized they had dates on them. They were only redeemable that night. So I put to good use, I think I sprained my liver that night, but I went through all 20 of those 250 drink tickets, and then we went to an after-hours place, and then we went to the Alex Bennett show in the morning, and then I went to work. So, that ran about 3 years worth of doing stuff like that. Really puts miles on you.
Well, you know, one thing you had mentioned though about, you know, getting up and you know, absolutely bombing. that's what's good about the stand-up and the writing workshops is that, you know, when you start looking at material and the writing and the rhythm and the structure, sometimes it's just flip-flopping a word.
Yes.
Sometimes it's just changing one word out, you know? I mean, it sounds stupid to say some words are funnier than others, but they are, you know? It's like, don't say that. Say this,
yes.
You know, take this out. Take a pause right here. Let the audience
yeah.
get it. And then hit them. And so I think that's with the stand-up comedy workshops, that's what people get out of it, is that they get a chance to work out all the bugs and kinks. And you know, when I had my first stand-up comedy debut, all my people got laughs.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some jokes didn't work out, but, you know, there were no tears,
like
you know.
Yeah. And to work it out in your workshops where you're getting... If it doesn't work, you can get some constructive criticism,
mm-hmm.
like
yeah.
flip that phrase, use this word,
right.
maybe this name or whatever mm-hmm. in the story or in the joke, as opposed to the guy in the back
right.
of the room just heckling you or booing
right.
with nothing positive to say. So
yeah.
being able to do that in a supportive atmosphere, great.
Yeah.
Well, sounds good. How we good?
I think we're
Sounds good.
Good.
All right. So plug it again. Where can they hear you? Where can they get a hold of you? Mile High.
MileHighComedyTheater.com. Go through the Contact Us page if you need any more information. If you want to sign up for the free improvisational comedy class on January 31st, again, go through that contact page. Let me know you're going to be there, and we'll take care of you. We'll have fun. We'll play games, and you'll have a blast.
Good deal. And don't forget, January 23rd at the Elks, there's info on there and how to get mm-hmm. tickets by contacting the Elks.
And you know what? Because you did bring up booze. One thing people may not
this
know.
Cranberry
juice and soda. But the Elks is now selling beer and wine.
Oh, nice.
So people that want to go out and, you know, have a little glass of wine and, you know.
Let me ask you, age restriction on the show on the 23rd? I forgot to ask.
Here's the thing.
Note to self, these questions
before. Well, no. And we have this on our posters. Our suggested audience age is 18 and over.
18 and over.
Because you don't know where things are going to go. We don't strive to do blue material.
Yeah.
We don't strive to be vulgar. But sometimes a joke goes where the audience
exactly.
wants it to. So, again, we don't strive. I prefer to be witty and satirical than lowbrow. Or
plus
scatological,
yeah.
do scatological humor, but you know what?
Plus, you're doing jokes that kids may not necessarily just get,
right.
you know, the humor there. So 18 and over suggested.
Yes.
Again, MileHighComedyTheater.com.
Mm-hmm. Prescott Oaks Theater.
Got all the links right on the website.
Yep.
Check them out, and don't forget the free workshop on the 31st.
Yes.
I think
yeah.
we got it covered.
All right.
We good?
Yeah, this has
All
been
right,
awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for
Appreciate
having me.
Appreciate it, Cynthia.
It was fun.
Well, that's our show. We hope you enjoyed our talk with Cynthia Sobo of the Mile High Comedy Theater. Their upcoming show this Friday, January 23rd at the Elks Theater in downtown Prescott. Give the Elks a call at 928-777-1370 or check out MileHighComedyTheater.com. For all the info. That's just one of the events we have this week in Prescott and Prescott Valley. We've got some great entertainment, including also on Friday night, January 23rd, the Great Gig in the Sky at the Prescott Valley Event Center. Check out PrescottValleyEventCenter.com for tickets for that. It's a fantastic Pink Floyd tribute show featuring the music from The Wall, including light show and a bunch of video. All kind of magic going on. And also more comedy at Brick and Bones, stand-up comedy featuring several stand-ups from around the state. Check out our website, milehighshow.com, for information on all the upcoming fun stuff to do in Prescott, Arizona. So thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Don't forget to, when you visit our website, click that donate button. Drop a couple of dollars into our buckets from PayPal there so we can take care of our guests, get some merch and some gifts for our audience as well. Look for some bigger upcoming live shows we'll be recording at various venues around our area. We've got a great new, what may be our new home base with a new bar and restaurant opening up in Prescott Valley. More information on that to come. So thanks again. Check us out every Monday on all the regular outlets, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, all the good stuff. Thanks for listening. That's our show.